Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your raving with Sana Marin of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Too many ones and alls, thumbing through these racks, my system overload. Ain't no stunt on me, I went beyond your goal. I'm too OP for this path I chose. Give me that paddock, need that.
Shout out to Young Thug, shout out to Bloody J. That's Florida Water, but not the Florida Water that I prefer. It's Florida Water, which is a song by FN Mecca and Gunna and Klix, maybe? TBD. FN Mecca might be an artificial intelligence rapper which has had a challenging couple of weeks, was recently dropped from Capitol Records. This is sort of an annoying story, but it does bring up some interesting issues about ethics in the music business and also the nature of artistry and the relationship between art and technology, and at what point the human aspect of creating gets subsumed by technological concerns. It got me thinking about big picture questions like that. And so we're going to talk today first about the FN Mecca scandal. Joe is going to be here, and also Ryan Broderick is going to be here. And then I also thought that the FN Mecca scandal really felt like an unconscious echo of the Spotify fake songs storyline that's been bubbling for several years and been covered extensively by music business websites. And so in the second half of this episode, Tim Ingham is going to call in and we're going to talk about the history of quote unquote fake artists on Spotify. These are all big picture questions and frankly, things that come up when it comes to Muzak and sound alike music and commercials and avatars. We've talked about avatars on podcasts before. The relationship between a listener and an artist is always mediated, but the lines of mediation have been moving. So this episode, we're going to talk about two different scenarios in which those lines have been fudged and moved, perhaps to uncomfortable places. Before we get into that, just a note about the live event, September 15th at Gertie in Brooklyn. We put out a bunch of tickets. I posted the link on the Facebook and the Discord. And now those tickets are gone. They went very fast. They went overnight. Wow. Not prepared for that. Very, very excited and touched and really just pumped to see everybody at the event. Also, I'm pretty sure what we're going to do is we'll do the recording and then we're just going to open the doors up and anybody who either couldn't make it to the recording, didn't get a ticket or just couldn't make the time, I think we're going to hang out for a little while afterwards. So if you want to come later that night, 9:30, 10 o'clock, I'm pretty sure we'll be hanging for a little bit. We're also going to put out some more tickets. We were holding back a few tickets because we weren't sure of the exact capacity. Probably a little bit closer to Labor Day, we will re-up that link and there'll be some more tickets available. And everybody who can come, I'm excited to see you. If you're not able to get a ticket, obviously, I apologize. We will try to do another one of these and make more room for everybody. But check the Facebook, check the Discord, Instagram, Twitter, etc. And I'll post the link when we re-up it in a week or so. Back to business. We're going to talk about the fakery today, the fakery, the scammery, all of the above. FN Mecca is allegedly, a lot of allegedlys in this episode. I just want to like say that up front. It's a lot of allegedlys in this episode. An artificial intelligence rapper, it quote marks around every word I'm going to say for the next like 30 to 60 minutes. So there was a song that was put out. First of all, FN Mecca was signed to Capitol Records and now has been dropped. I don't know how you can sign and drop a creation of a computer, but hey, here we are. It's 2022. We're going to talk about the ethical implications of artificial intelligence and also just, frankly, the freaking goofiness of this entire escapade. Joe Coscarelli is here. Hey, boo.
Hey.
Also, I want to say we were listening at the beginning of this episode to the song that has been largely memory-holed from the internet, which is called Florida Water, which is FN Mecca with Gunna, Free Gunna. Obviously, also Free Gunna from this song, frankly, but this has been memory hold larger than the internet. But here it is for you on podcast. Also joining us is Ryan Broderick. Ryan writes the Garbage Day newsletter. Go subscribe to that on Substack. Excellent internet newsletter. Ryan, welcome to podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Happy to have you. Also, I know, Ryan, you're very heavy on the emo revivals.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you've been on my mind for a long time because I was like, we got to have him on the emo episode whenever we get around to it. But here we are. I was like, no, let's have a dumber subject, frankly.
Wait, Ryan, which wave are you riding?
I'm pretty current.
Oh, you're riding this big wave. Yeah, you're currently riding the wave.
Yeah, but I have been for a while. You know, I loved the emo revival of like the Snowing era, you know, like I was just listening to the new Front Bottom song like 10 minutes ago.
So there we go.
You know, I'm wow. still around.
Active.
Can you call it a revival if it never left?
If it never this went away.
This is going to be the subject for the eventual podcast.
Yeah, I don't want to get too deep into it, but I do love that these revival waves are getting shorter. So, you know, like I'm pretty sure Fifth Wave Emo is just, at this point, one Hot Mulligan EP. You know, it's just they're just getting smaller and smaller, which is great for me.
Other philosophical conundrum. This came up last week on the Rage Against the Machine episode where Joey was like, you can't really call it a reunion or a comeback because they never really totally broke up. And I was just like, I'm pretty sure if you go away for 11 years, I think you get tagged as a comeback regardless. Like, I don't care if you guys stayed on the group chat in the intervening decade. Like,
or if still, group chat was invented in the intervening true. Decades.
Yeah, the group Friendster message or whatever. You know, like, I just don't know. Okay. We're delaying the inevitable. We're going to talk about FN Mecca.
Yeah.
Okay. Joe, you sent me a couple days ago a genius video about artificial intelligence rappers from early last year that I thought was like actually very thorough.
Yeah, that's uppercase G genius.
Yes. Correct. Genius.com. And I thought it was very thorough. People should go check that out. There's some interviews in there and a little bit of bigger picture context. Included in that roundup was FN Mecca, which is basically just Tekashi 6ix9ine without the real life stress, basically. Joe, how and why? Like, I don't even have like a more substantive question. How and why?
I want to be really honest here. I tried my hardest not to pay attention to this years and weeks. I've tried to make it a personal mission of mine to never write about AI or NFTs and how they relate to music, which like maybe means my head is in the sand or maybe means like I have aesthetic and moral and ethical standards. But I just, to me, it's just always been one big scam and sham. And I think that this only feeds that. Yeah, so to be completely honest, the day this FN Mecca story was really peaking, you know, I had seen mention of it over the past, I believe the single came out on August 12th. So it was like basically almost 2 weeks of growing jokes, chatter, backlash. Like I would say the backlash always had a humorous component to it. Shout out to Big Business on Twitter and like some of those people who were really going in on this. But essentially, this AI powered rapper, which is it AI? Is it VR? Is it AR? What are these terms?
Just a guy.
Mean? Yeah, look, like it turns out maybe this is just a cartoon avatar for a boardroom, a virtual boardroom of creators. But I really didn't start paying attention to this until Industry Blackout, which is an activist group that formed in the summer of 2020. Around equity in the music business, part of, you know, larger social justice conversations that were happening then. They put out a statement that was basically like, and I thought this was very strongly worded. It had very specific demands. And they said, essentially, Capital Music Group, you need to sever all ties with this artist, apologize, donate any money that you spent on this to actual Black artists on your label, fill their marketing budgets, basically pay restitution for taking what is a pretty plainly minstrelly caricature of the worst aspects of hip hop and trying to make money off of it. So basically, I saw that post. I immediately hit the label up and said, what are you guys going to do about this? Thinking maybe I'd write about it in a day or two if it really came to a head. And then I immediately was hit back saying, we're dropping this rapper. We'll send you a statement in 30 seconds. I think, you know, that indicates to me that they were already sort of noticing that this was becoming a problem. We're already moving in this direction. I don't think they pounced just because the New York Times emailed them about it. I don't think even the Industry Blackout thing may have not been the total impetus. Like, this wave was growing over the past days and weeks. And I think it was just pretty plain to see how this was going to end from the second you found out about FN Mecca, whether you were paying attention when Jacques made this great genius video in 2021 or whether you just got up on it over the last couple of days.
Ryan, before we kind of go and double down onto the ethical questions, can we talk about the technological questions for a second? So much of this feels, again, alleged. It is being sold as artificial intelligence. It does not feel particularly intelligent and frankly, not even very artificial in the sense that it's trying to emulate a real thing. It feels deliberately, you know, Joe said avatar. It reminds me a fair amount of the sort of Travis Scott Fortnite moment. Shout out to Alyssa from The Ringer, who was on our episode about avatars in pop music. Obviously, your Hatsune Mikos of the world. What's actually happening on the technological side from to the best of your perspective?
So I'm glad you brought up Hatsune Miku, because we have to sort of start with her. So for your listeners who like aren't familiar with this kind of weird world of virtual influencers, Hatsune Miku is like probably the first and most notable, and she's what's called a Vocaloid. She's essentially open source. And if you want to make a song with Hatsune Miku's voice, you can do that. If you want to get a rig and set her up and make her dance, you can do that. And that technology has evolved so that there's an entire subculture on YouTube of what are called VTubers, who are people who stream as anime characters for hours at a time, and they all have different personalities, and there's a whole fandom there. So whenever you encounter a virtual influencer, you're trying to figure out, like, what is the virtual part? What is the AI part? There were a couple similar experiments. One was called Little Maquila, who I think is still active on Instagram.
And in a Gucci campaign or something? I don't know. In some fashion yes. campaign as well recently.
Yeah, they keep trying to force this thing to happen. And it's like very strange. I think the big question is like, what is the virtual part? What is the AI part? What is happening here? So based on what we know about FN Mecha, it's a human voice. And the company Factory New that's behind the character was scouring the web for data points, they called them, and putting them together in some kind of algorithm to generate music and possibly lyrics for this human voice to perform, which was then animated by a virtual avatar. To me, that's not anything. That's like literally nothing. I mean, half of that is what Drake already does.
And frankly, many artists for the last 15 years.
Sure, or something like Gorillaz, which is right. Like real musicians with that only present as cartoons, essentially.
Yeah, and I meant like Drake in the sense like scouring through industry trends and putting them together in different ways. This is not new. But these companies like Factory New know that AI is a buzzy word. There was like a whole controversy around a Reuters piece a couple weeks ago where they said that there was finally going to be a metaverse pop star, and all the comments on Twitter were people just being like, where have you been for 15 years? This is a thing. But it keeps happening. And I think it's because these companies know that there's just a lot of places that will write this stuff up and not think about it. And FM Mecha had a fairly big following on TikTok. But if you go through the comments, like, it wasn't like positive. It wasn't like a real fandom. And it was also getting progressively uglier and grosser as I think its fan base grew.
But attention, I mean, look, negative attention still qualifies as attention. And the FM Mecha stuff before there were songs, quote unquote, it was sort of like digital troll content, kind of.
It's important to note who the touchstones were, right? When this thing was invented, which you can get some of the backstory in that Genius video we mentioned, but this came out of the time of Lil Pump, 6ix9ine, and TK specifically. There's some Travis Scott thrown in there because he's as much of an avatar as a human could possibly be already. But you think of 6ix9ine, you think of Lil Pump, especially the negative attention was the cell. This character was originally created to fight a 6ix9ine avatar in a video game that was like a play on Def Jam Wrestling.
Yeah.
Right. So this began as a video game character and a sort of parody of the already parodic rappers who were gaining attention in that moment, more so than it began as a music project.
So the technology, the alleged technology, is basically just a buzzword scam.
Yeah, maybe. I don't get the sense that there's any motion tracking going on. I haven't seen a live stream or anything of FN Mecha. And I don't get the sense that it was anything other than kind of generically put together trap songs. They hired like a person to sing it, and then they would have an animator just animate it. And then I would love to see their music generating algorithm, their songwriting algorithm, but I'm convinced that it's not nearly as sophisticated as this man who was involved in the New Jersey rap metal scene is making it out to sound.
One thing that I was struck by, I think on Instagram sometime in the last few days, maybe a rapper from Dallas who had been hired to voice FN Mecha essentially came out and talked about it. And in that Genius video, there was the Travis bot thing, which I had not previously been forced to confront in my life. But there it was in this video. And then there was a rapper who had been hired to voice Travis bot. So there are, I guess, quote unquote, real rappers behind this. And we're going to talk about this a tiny bit philosophically in the second segment of this episode about fake artists on Spotify. But there is also the issue of E-Town Concrete. Joe, you want to dial everybody in to E-Town Concrete?
the conglomerate of names and sort of fake buzzword companies behind FN Mecca. You know, you have Factory New, you have the Lee brothers from Salt Lake City who originally created this video game character. You mentioned the rapper who voiced the earlier songs. I believe he goes by Kyle the Hooligan, who was cut out of the project before it made its way to Capitol Records. And then you have this guy, Anthony Martini, who, as you guys hinted at, was part of what do you call it? Like a rap metal band?
We were talking about waves of emo. Let's call it third wave rap metal. Let's call it that.
They were like a metalcore band that rapped, essentially.
Yes. And those songs are out there. You can find them. They have some maybe questionable lyrics that haven't aged that well. But yeah, take a little dive down the E-Town Concrete thing. But so this guy, Anthony Martini, was, you could say he's like the manager of FN Mecca. How do we gender FN Mecca? Is it a he, or is it a they, or is it it?
Ooh, good point. Let's say it.
I think I went with he.
If the AI was better, I would say he, but I think it hasn't reached that level of sentience yet. I think it's still it.
So Anthony had been doing these interviews over the last couple of years about this project. Music Business Worldwide, I think, actually covered the quote-unquote rise of FN Mecca pretty well. But, you know, he's a white guy from, I guess, New Jersey. He was really talking up the AI technology in the past. But when I reached him on the day FN Mecca was dropped by Capitol Music Group, he right away was saying, you know, there was some trolling going on. There was some talking up the AI components. I read him back a quote of his where he says, the lyrical content, chords, melody, tempo, sounds, we combine these elements to create the song using AI technology. And he was sort of like hemming and hawing. Well, it wasn't quite that. So like, I get the sense that all of the AI of this was overstated. I think there was a moment maybe where they did like some feeding in songs to pick a tempo and generate some words, but also this is just a bunch of guys behind various computers. Anthony Martini, you know, he was pretty defiant about it.
Didn't he say he was the only, he said he was the only white guy involved?
Yeah, he was like, look, this is a really diverse team. The rapper behind this is a black guy. He wouldn't name who the current rapper is, who the voice of FN Mecca Capitol Music Group artist for 2 weeks was. But yeah, he said, I'm the only white guy involved. He said that this is a clickbait story, you know, being taken out of context, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I mean, look, this is just people trying to keep their jobs and trying to prove that they're on the new stuff. There's a guy, I guess his name is Ryan Rudin. His title is Executive Vice President of Experiential Marketing and Business Development at Capitol Music Group. And from what's out there and from what I gathered, he's the guy who was like, this wasn't like a typical, I don't think your big record label A&Rs were sitting in a meeting saying, oh, these FN Mecca songs slap. This was an experiential marketing and business development signing.
Okay. Philosophical question. I know that this has caused just a huge kerfuffle. What a mess. What a nightmare. Here we are talking about it. I'm so resentful. I wish I never had to think about this, but here we are, right? But are we not sort of just like forestalling the inevitable, which is that 10, 20, 30 years from now, a not insignificant portion of what we currently think of as pop music or the major label ecosystem in popular music is going to be some version of avatar-driven or avatar-focused music and potentially algorithmically derived music. Now, in the Genius video, the algorithmically derived Travis Scott lyrics were sort of funny because they were both completely inscrutable and, frankly, not that far off from actual Travis Scott lyrics. I don't think you could do that with Nas lyrics or Jay-Z lyrics or Gucci Mane lyrics, but, you know, not everybody is seeking lyricism on that level. Is this not just a hiccup on the road in this direction anyway? Ryan, what do you think?
Maybe. I think like algorithmically generated music is getting better. I mean, if you want to hear like a really funny example, there's a YouTube channel, I think it's still active, that just streams algorithmically generated death metal 24/7.
Damn.
And there's no lyrics.
Does it hit?
It's just like,
does it hit?
It's some of it's pretty good, but it does have that like artificial sound to it where you're like, oh, this was clearly generated by a computer. But most music production software these days has elements to it that you would say is an AI or an algorithm helping it. You know, Ableton is like a really popular one. Ableton can warp songs where it analyzes their BPM and allows you to mix and match them together in all different ways. And you can download a plugin that'll help you do any part of the music production process and it'll speed that up. Are they good? Debatable, but they're getting better. So I think to answer one half of that question, we're already at a point where I would say a good chunk of pop music is probably algorithmically or AI driven to some degree, and we don't even really think about it. As the other half of the question, though, is more complicated to me, we've tried to make avatars stick so many times, and it comes around like every 5 years where everyone's like, no one's going to be human anymore, and we're all going to want to go see cartoon characters perform or whatever. I don't see it sticking. It's always stayed the subcultural thing, and I'm not sure, particularly in America, I don't really see it happening. I actually see it kind of going the other way where human pop stars start to act more like avatars. You could argue the Kardashians are essentially avatars. You could argue that certain pop stars have become... Lady Gaga changes her avatar every couple of years.
Yeah, John and I saw one at Madison Square Garden last week.
Oh, swish. Nothing but net from half court. as I said on Instagram, his name is not Harry Songs. So,
look, I think, Ryan, I think you're totally right. I think it's actually the FN Mecca backlash is really telling because, yes, there's the racial component of it, which is like the minstrelsy aspect. The image I think that really stuck with people was of FN Mecca being beaten by a cop in prison and saying, like, you know, free me, I won't snitch. That was from like 2019. I mean, like, that, okay, that's disgusting on all levels. But I think the real rejection of this character was on aesthetic and artistic grounds. It's just like video games should stay in video games. I think people don't want this, even if it were not offensive on a moral or ethical or racial level. I think it's just most people don't want to see a character that looks like this.
Yeah, but we're old. What, maybe 15-year-olds want this? I don't know. Maybe I should add a 15-year-old on here to talk about FN Mecca and the avatar AI ecosystem. Is there not something that's become more normalized generationally towards engaging with playing virtual characters, like living in virtual worlds? Like, obviously, it's not something that brings me any joy or sparks any curiosity really on my end, but that doesn't mean that there's not a generational wave coming where for whom this is going to be normalized.
Yeah, I think, look, if you like video games and anime, sure.
Well, that's like everyone. That's literally everyone under 25.
There is a good example. There is a good mainstream example of this. Well, not quite mainstream, but almost mainstream, which is Corpse Husband, the Twitch streamer who no one knows who he is, what he looks like. And
mainstream is different than my mainstream, Ryan. I'll say that.
he did the Among Us stream with AOC. He's done tracks with Machine Gun Kelly.
Who among us? First of all, everybody on this episode has done a track with Machine Gun Kelly. Like, not literally.
Yeah, I have one coming out next week. Yeah.
I did watch the AOC stream. I did not listen to the Machine Gun Kelly Corpse Husband collab.
It's fine.
Wait, let's listen to it. Like, wait, all right, Pedro, we got to play that. I don't even know what it sounds like, but we got to play 20 seconds. Fight, fight,
fight. Yeah, yeah. They tried to kill me in the rain. Tried to let me down, so I ducked and ran away. Put a gun up to my face. I was eating at your case. When I find this spot, then I lay on his grave. All these rays of lights. I want to know if I tell you.
It sounds like Kids Bop, Mindless Self-Indulgence. But, so...
That sounds like a banger. Like, I don't know.
It's fine. But I do think he's an interesting example of this where he has a cartoon face that he uses and no one knows what he looks like in real life and no one kind of cares. People keep trying to dox him, but it doesn't really work. And you see this also outside of music with Dream, the Minecraft player, who's like the biggest streamer in the world. There's experiments with pseudonymity, anonymity, avatars. It's all happening, but it's not happening the way FN Mecca was doing it. It's like the human being is the famous part. And the identity is the secondary part. It's almost the reverse of FN Mecca.
Yes, although I guess I wonder, as we move more towards avatar lifestyle, and by we, I mean not me, but other people move more towards avatar lifestyle, is this not just going to be fundamentally normalized? Like, I worry that the spectacle and the kind of garishness and the specificity, the temporal specificity also of FN Mecca, which feels, as Joe was saying, extremely 2019, that all of those things are kind of obscuring the larger philosophical idea, which is that there is going to be algorithmic or artificial intelligence generated music. It will probably get quote unquote better. It will be presented on the internet or on our phones in ways, or in VR, in ways that are like far more alluring than it is now. And we'll just seem like old fuddy-duddies. when people listen back to this.
I appreciate that perspective. But I also, John, I think it's particularly prickly and problematic in rap, especially in this moment where the biggest rap is, for lack of a better word, like we're still obsessed with authenticity of street rappers specifically. And to juxtapose this cartoon, this major label cartoon, with Gunna on his first single, somebody who is currently sitting in a Georgia prison, you know, with no bond on charges that reference his lyrics. Like, it's just, it's incredibly tone deaf, but I just don't see how you ever get past the hurdle of rap needing to come from somebody's lived experience.
You don't think that we are ever going to arrive at an all hologram / AI Rolling Loud?
I think we might, but I would hope that most audiences will continue to reject it. Again, if only on aesthetic and artistic grounds.
Ryan, where is this? Where are we going from here? Do you think that there's inevitability to this? Or does this feel like if we all speak up against this now, maybe we can just nip it in the bud?
I think the human will remain central. I think we tend to like stuff that other human beings make.
That's an amazing sentence.
But there's a big but there, which is that I think that we have not, and I think it's really hard to predict this, but in the same way that the internet just created a bunch of new types of things that kids go crazy for, right? We have this future ahead of us where AI could unpredictably generate something that like kids are just super into. Like a really weird story, but like quickly, like, you know, I met my friend's kid a while ago, a couple years ago, and the kid was super into YouTube videos of different color trains, like CGI trains. And the kid was just hooked on this algorithmically generated video of a train. And, you know, it's like this like thing where you just like become obsessed with it and you can't explain why. And I think AI opens the door to like bizarre forms of media just being invented at random. And then young people might be really into it. But I think for now, we want human-made stuff.
Yeah, I mean, wait till this kid sees a real train. It's going to blow his mind.
Or he might be like, yo, this
what
is
if it does?
He might be like, this is type corny. Like, this has got nothing on these like, YouTube trains. These YouTube trains are,
yeah, exactly.
Are lit.
It's like, this is boring.
I guess to just slightly problematize the thing that you just said about humans liking a thing that other humans make, I feel like the potential challenge here is, if you're young, especially, you may not know the difference between something that was made by a human or something that was made, quote unquote, by an algorithm or by an artificial intelligence vehicle. And so there may not be that critical filtering system that all of us deploy every day and allow us to say things like FN Mecca or Goofy. That may not be in play. And then if you have a generation that has not been acclimated that way, but has been acclimated, in fact, the other way, then it may not matter. Also, as a counterpoint, oftentimes the first time we encounter a piece of art, whether it's actual art on a wall, something on the computer, a song, something on a screen, we don't necessarily know the authorial intent behind it. We don't necessarily understand it. Now, I'm being a little bit loose here, because obviously if you're watching an NBA Youngboy video, it's like you basically understand the authorial intent. But it's possible that people's emotional connections to the art is formed and sticks before you ever get to the stickier philosophical questions. And I think as more and more art is created algorithmically and is pushed through vehicles and mechanisms and in milieu where the creator is not necessarily at the front, I think more and more people are going to learn to disassociate the art from the creator, and then that will create an ecosystem that's much safer for algorithmic art. I don't like it necessarily, wow. But I think that's going to happen.
Wow. You're going to push me into cultural long-termism, saving art made by humans.
We just absolutely, we threw down the gauntlet. We are old. We're the old guard. We're officially the old guard as of this episode.
Well, it's like the kids who are only raised on movies post-Marvel.
I was going to say, Marvel looms over this whole conversation. People don't care that none of these actors are in the same room and that they didn't do anything you're seeing them do on screen.
Big facts. Yeah. Big facts. Well, this is both fascinating, upsetting, a little bit frightening, and lightly grotesque. And I'm so glad that y'all walked down this incredibly uncomfortable hot coal walk with me.
Yeah, what we need is Rap Game Top Gun Maverick. We need to bring back practical effects.
I don't even understand that joke.
Some people will understand it. Don't worry.
Fine. Okay. That's I do enough inside jokes. You can have one too. Ryan, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
Joe, big smooches.
I don't think this was great, but I'm happy we did.
Okay, fine. Let's go into the break with a little bit of
some Travis Bott.
Some Travis Bott. I'm so sorry. Please, all the listeners, please forgive me. I know you talking trippy on my plate.
Spelling Bee is one of the first things I do when I get up.
I feel like I play Spelling Bee in all the little in-between moments of the day.
I tend to look for every four-letter word I can find, often making some up.
Mopatel.
Tally app. Tilapia. There we go.
I go through and try to get the pangram.
Pangram, which I often call panagram, and you often say it's pangram, is when you find a word, sometimes there's more than one, which is pretty fun, using all of the letters.
Whenever I get a pangram, it makes me feel incredible.
Palatial.
We already have that. There was one with like X. I was like, what? How am I supposed to use X?
I feel like I'm actually doing something good with my time. I'm working my brain a little bit.
Okay, I'm gonna do three more words and then I'm done.
You can try Spelling Bee and all New York Times games
at nytimes.com/games.
Right now you can get 50% off your first year if you subscribe by September 25th, and you can cancel anytime.
We're back for part two of this week's podcast. And one of the things that I was thinking about in the wake of the whole FN Mecha thing is, forgive me for getting philosophical, but what exactly is the difference between a real and fake artist? I understand the agony of working musicians. I understand it is a poorly paid, especially at the lower levels. I know it is a tough business to be a creative person trying to make a living doing something like making music. And one flashpoint over the last few years that's really brought up a lot of issues around labor and economic security in the music business is the rise of so-called fake artists on Spotify. If you're thinking about FN Mecha as algorithmic AI, fake artist, all of those words probably not actually real. But anyway, if you're thinking about that one version, here's a different kind of version. And what this is basically are artists' songs that populate important Spotify playlists that are essentially being made specifically for that purpose. They're not by known performers. They're not, or at least not publicly by known performers. And this has been going on for at least a few years. One of the people who's been covering this incredibly aggressively is Tim Ingham. Tim is the founder and publisher of Music Business Worldwide, which is a British industry publication, and has been all up on this. Tim, welcome to Popcast. Let's get involved. First of all, hi. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you, John. Pleasure to be with you.
I'm psyched to have you. I've been reading your site for a long time, and I've been reading your coverage of this for a long time. And to be honest, over the last few years, I haven't really wanted to cover this because I'm just like, the internal politics of Spotify don't excite me that much. But if we're going to talk about what people are gravitating to in terms of so-called real versus fake artists, you have to look at this ecosystem. Spotify is where so many people are living right now. And clearly someone in that office realized that there was money to be made off of this kind of alternate form of music making. Can you kind of map out the early stages of the so-called fake artist conundrum on Spotify, and then we'll walk towards where we are right now?
In around 2015, I started hearing from, I can sort of name their classification now. At the time, they were a top secret source, but a producer friend in Sweden told me that there were deals being done, allegedly, directly between Spotify and very talented musicians in Sweden to create music that is under pseudonymous artist names. And so one of these musicians might create music by 20 different artists, all under certain themes, which we'll come back to. There is still some debate as to whether there was ever a direct conversation between Spotify and these musicians or if it all went via a third party. But what we do know is this practice took place, this practice kicked off, and a lot of money has been made by the musicians behind the fake artistry and the companies who have commissioned the musicians behind the fake artistry. And where things get particularly intriguing is there has been a suspiciously high volume of music by artists recording under fake names that have appeared in first-party Spotify playlists, i.e. Spotify is channeling its listeners to listen to music by musicians who are not named on its service. And that's where the suspicion in all of this first got raised.
And now, those musicians who were allegedly being contracted to make this music are musicians who were known in other contexts as maybe more conventional pop producers, pop songwriters, things of that nature?
Well, we didn't actually know the answer to that until earlier this year when there was a fantastic investigatory piece written by the Swedish newspaper DN. I won't try and pronounce their full name, but DN will have to do.
Shout out DN. Shout out DN. We respect you even if we can't pronounce you.
Good man. There is a musician, and I'll do my best of pronunciation. Apologies to our friends in the Nordics. And I believe he's called Krista Sandelin, and he was something of a well-known singer in Sweden, I believe, in the 80s and 90s. The sort of softer side of alternative rock is my understanding. So you're sort of looking at an equivalent of a Duran Duran, maybe, or a Spandau Ballet in my fine country. And he has been named by DN as being incredibly successful writing this music behind the scenes. I believe that there are tens, if not hundreds, of fake artists who actually are said gentleman, Krista, if I've got that right, or Krista. And so we do know for sure that there are musicians who have been somewhat part of the pop realm, the public-facing popular music realm. But this is the first one that we know for sure has come from that background. What we do also know, because I noticed you used the word allegedly, and we will be careful, but we know for a fact that there is a company called Epidemic Sound, which is valued at over $1 billion in Sweden. It is one of those rare, rare unicorns in this world. And the founder of Epidemic Sound, Oscar, has gone on the record to confirm that his company is behind many of the so-called fake artists. He really doesn't like that phrase. I think it sums it up rather nicely. And it's intriguing to me that Epidemic Sound is Swedish. A lot of this activity has happened on Spotify, which is also Swedish. And that there, the DN investigation has found a label in Sweden called Firefly, which has also been incredibly successful peddling fake artists onto Spotify. And again, a suspicious number of those fake artists have ended up on first-party Spotify playlists. Now, if you're a young musician from Atlanta, Seattle, Argentina, wherever we want to pick, your dream, right, in the modern music industry, rather sadly, but true, is to land on one of those first-party Spotify playlists. Your career changes overnight. Spotify and its own marketing materials talks up the power of its first-party playlists. So the big question for me has always been, why is Spotify putting so many, quote-unquote, fake artists on those playlists? I think we all know the answer because you follow the money in most of these situations.
So basically, and to spell it out, Spotify has to pay what I would gather is a lower royalty to the people who make this music than to the people who are signed to Universal Records, Interscope Records, Atlantic Records, so on and so forth. Is that safe to say?
Summing things up from my perspective, I believe that's all accurate and true. Others would disagree, so we'll be careful. Yeah, again, but what I will say is we know for a fact, and I won't get too in the weeds of music industry terminology, but we know for a fact that Spotify has to pay what's called performance royalties to organizations in your fine country. That would be like ASCAP and BMI. You may have heard of those groups. And those then get passed on to songwriters. And we also know that certainly up until the last time I looked, certainly for the last few years, that if you sign up as a musician to Epidemic Sound, which, as I said, is one of these middlemen passing this music by pseudonymous artists onto Spotify and getting on the playlist, if you sign up to that company and do a deal with that company, they will not allow you to have this music signed up to performance rights organizations. So in other words, there wouldn't be a need to pay those performance rights organizations if that music gets paid. As to what the direct deal is between Spotify and those companies, I would certainly suspect that, you know, and economically agreeable terms have been reached by both parties, and it may or may not be, I would certainly suggest or suspect that it would be, cheaper for Spotify to play that music than to play, as you point out, music that is signed to major record companies.
Let me ask this question. The nature of the deal that you're describing between songwriters and these labels that are serving as intermediaries to Spotify for these so-called fake artists. So you're saying they don't have access to essentially royalty payments. Are they getting a one-time fee up front and then never to be paid again?
That is interesting because historically, Epidemic Sound, which is the company I've been referencing, there are a few of these companies. I don't want to pick on just one. And Epidemic Sound's been hugely successful in what it does. And also, I should point out that I'm not questioning the musical aptitude, creativity, what have you, of the actual human musicians
in the background.
Right, we're
going to get to that.
Right, good. But what we do know is that Epidemic Sound historically, and this doesn't happen anymore, they have clarified this. I think it stopped happening in about 2016. Historically, it was the kind of deal you're talking about. I, as a musician, would go up to you, Epidemic Sound executive, and say, how does this work? And you would say, I'm going to write you a check here and now to basically buy out all of your rights. We're going to own the music, and then we're going to rinse it and see how much money we can get from it. At some point, something changed there where Epidemic Sound still buys out all the rights. They still own all the rights. You, as the musician, do not. Certainly in the case of the music I'm talking about here, the fake artist music, but they do pass through to you a royalty stream. So you do continue to earn off the music. You do get an upfront check, but what you don't have is your own rights.
Because obviously one of the business challenges or conundrums of the streaming era, and this is something you see obviously in the Netflix ecosystem and so on and so forth, is how are residuals handled? And this is something that comes up with actors. There have been a couple of interviews recently where actors have been griping that if you appear on a show on a streaming platform, you're not entitled to the residual checks that the actors from the 70s, 80s, and 90s get every time someone syndicates an episode of, who even knows, some terrible Michael Landon show from the 1980s. So part of this, I guess I would have assumed, is that economic conundrum, but that's not what's in play, you're saying, or at least not with this company specifically.
I think the bigger issue is we don't know exactly what the deal that's been done between Epidemic Sound and the artist is. All we know that Epidemic Sound and companies like it end up owning the rights in perpetuity, and that the artists that they work with end up being paid a certain amount of streaming revenue, a certain percentage, in the same way that a royalty would work traditionally. But we don't know what that percentage is. We don't know how it compares to if you'd have signed to Universal Music Group or Epitaph or any other record label. And we don't know what the size of the check was up front. My suspicion, what I suspect is taking place, is this is, to put it frank, it's pilot high, sell it cheap music. You sit in a studio, you write and record as much as humanly possible in a 48-hour period, and you get, you know, a nice recompense for that. But ultimately, what you're not trying to do is write the next Bohemian Rhapsody.
Apologies to my good friend Liz Pelly. I'm a devil's advocate here real quick for a second. There are plenty of working musicians before this issue, before 2015, plenty of working musicians who work in the area of Muzak or Muzak type music, interstitial music, library music, so on and so forth. This kind of music production creation is not totally novel. It's not completely out of bounds that certain musicians are not necessarily working towards the pop charts or, you know, a big genre hit or something like that. They're simply working studio musicians making music to fill in all the kind of, like, dare I say, unromantic spaces that music goes.
I've got 2 points to make on that. The first blames Spotify and the second blames the audience, which I think is where things will get interesting. The blame on Spotify for me, I think the most egregious thing I've seen in all of the fake artists reporting that Music Business Worldwide and myself has done is, so as I say, I started reporting on it 2015, 2016. By 2018, some of the quote-unquote fake artists, the pseudonymous artists that we had been writing about 2 years prior, now had millions of followers on Spotify, monthly listeners. But worse than that, in my opinion, Spotify had given them the equivalent of blue ticks. It had named them as verified artists. They'd named non-human creations as verified artists.
Are they non-human or are they just not publicly facing human?
To be clear, the name and personality that is being presented to you on Spotify is fictional. It is untrue and it is fake. And that is why I feel justified calling them fake artists. My bigger issue is the streaming era and Spotify itself. And I know there's lots of people who think they're the devil incarnate, but the streaming era, Spotify itself, has done incredible things for the music industry. And yes, a handful, a relative handful, thousands, tens of thousands, whatever it might be, of artists in this space. It has changed the game for the music industry in a number of positive ways. One of the really negative ways, and there's no blood on the hands of Spotify here, or indeed TikTok or any other applications and platforms that have utilized modern technology to become woven into the modern music industry, is I feel like the audience is less invested in the artists that they are listening to than ever before. The audience, and the statistics will show this, the audience is less committed to a fewer number of artists. They're therefore arguably less interested in who those artists are, what their background is. And it's hard for the music industry that actually cares about the connection between art and the listener, which, believe it or not, in my opinion, is the majority of people working in it, that erodes their whole reason, the whole philosophy to be in this business, which is to change people's lives and introduce them to amazing, fantastic people who can make them think and feel differently. I did say I was going to blame the audience.
Right. Because I do think that there is a significant audience for music that does not function the way that you described. It's not me, and it's not you, and it's not most of my friends, or it's not the people who I respect their aesthetic positioning. But I do think out in the world, it is, the same people who don't care about fashion and buy clothes at The Gap or Old Navy or whatever. There are people who just want music to fill a hole.
Yes. I think that is true. However, I think that the streaming era and Spotify particularly, and again, I will put a little bit of their fact they're economically incentivized to do so on them for this. I think they have trained an entire generation to listen to music that way. And I feel like you now have music for running. You have music for running and working out. You have music to relax to. You have music to sleep to. Two of the playlists that are stuffed with the most fake artists that I've looked at over the years are called Deep Focus, which I actually use when I do
while I've been writing these reports.
I've been listening to these fake artists.
We're going to pull up Deep Focus right now. No. I can't believe it's... The call's coming from inside the house, Tim. Okay, so I'm looking at the Deep Focus playlist right now. The bio on it is keep calm and focus with ambient and post-rock music. I don't know, is Tortoise on this? Or any of the Chicago bands from the 90s on this? I don't think so. Okay, can you pull up this and can we choose one artist or artists that we believe to be fake artists to play for the people so that they know what they're getting into? I think the second one feels fakeish. What do you think, Electric Rivers?
I was overcome by a sense of incredibly deep focus, so I wouldn't know. Look, I'm not knocking the musicianship, and I won't, because literally it's done me favors over the years. It's made me better at running my business over the years.
If there was a tip jar, you'd put money in the tip jar.
I happily would. However, I would be slightly upset to know that, and I'm obviously being slightly facetious here, but that the first 60 tracks on the Deep Focus playlist that are being presented to me as 60 different people with 60 different lives and experiences are actually the same grizzled Swedish musician who reached number 38 on the Swedish pop charts in 1988. Like, I would be upset about that fact.
I'd never thought I'd have like such a philosophical difference here. But one of the worlds that I spent a lot of time in when I was younger is the dance music world. And in dance music and in club music, you have artists who release music under several different monikers. People who have a more techno-ish personality, a more house music, more garage personality. Is this radically different from that? Also, I do want to say, having listened to a couple of these songs in preparation for this and also just now, I'm not convinced that this music is that different from, say, the pop-oriented new age music of the late 80s into the early 90s. It feels like it has something in common with that space. So I guess if people want to go listen to Andreas Vollerwinder or whatever, like, you could do that. That's available to you too. Or you can get on the Deep Focus playlist. But please, tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, it's all about the intent. It's all about the intent. And the intent of the well-known or respected dance music producer who then creates his or her own pseudonymous personalities to play in different genres. And it's the argument that you can talk about. I know I should probably whisper a name these days, but J.K. Rowling writes in a pseudonym when she writes in different genres. It's about the intent and the fact that the listener either knows that that individual is behind it and knows who that individual is and can connect to them trying to do something different, or even better, the mystery around who it might be. The reason I find this very different is because we know that there is a calculated, greedy, almost venal reason for these fake artists to exist on these platforms. And we don't know where our money is going. We don't know who we're supporting when we listen to it. We don't know the level of creativity or otherwise of the individual behind it. And that, to me, I do find is the crucial difference.
Although maybe part of the issue that I'm having, or the leap that I'm having a trouble making, is I also find conventional pop music venal and profit oriented. and I don't know that I see the philosophical difference between this form of venality and the other form of venality. Like they both seem that way to me.
But I'm sure there are many, many artists you know about and love down the years. Shout out Loud of Mine, Right the Third. It's my favorite of all times. Got a new album out this week or last week.
Yes.
But people like that, right? And I just think, like, how many lives should that guy have changed had he been given the opportunity to be known about or used in the right movie or what have you? And I feel like it's upsetting to know that somebody is sitting in a studio creating music for no other reason than to generate as much revenue as possible in that given hour and doesn't even have the balls to put their own name on the music. Epidemic Sound, just to rewind you to the point that I think the central point as to why this feels icky is that Epidemic Sound carries a $1 billion valuation, partly because they've been so successful at this behind the scenes relationship with Spotify. And that's, to me, where it falls down, because let's not name any particular pop artists, but at least that pop artist is in the video. At least the pop artist is doing the promo and going to the million and one radio stations or whatever it may be. At least a human endeavor is involved and chronicled. And that is not happening with fake artistry.
Let me ask this question. And I truly don't know the answer to this question, because some of these artists, to your point, quote unquote artists, millions and millions of plays, millions of plays. And obviously part of the reason they're getting millions of plays is the nature of the milieu. It's a playlist. You put it on when you work. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of other people put it on when they work. It is designed to exist in a certain location. My former colleague Ben Ratliff has written a bit about mood-oriented music, locale-oriented music, music that makes sense for a specific kind of living moment. Have there been any quote-unquote artists who built upon the popularity that they have garnered on Spotify or other digital platforms, somehow taken it off Spotify, done shows, gone on tour, put out quote unquote albums, things of that nature? Has anything like that happened with anyone that you're aware of?
No, I mean, it's hilarious. If you go on Deep Focus today and you click all of the artists on there, which I've just been doing while we've been talking, you will struggle to find anyone with more than a million monthly listeners. And that's because these people have cottoned on to the fact that you don't want to get too big. This is what I was talking about before.
So that's purposeful, you think?
It's completely purposeful. That's what I was talking about before, when in 2018, I started to find that these individual artists had become so popular, even though they didn't actually exist, and that there was no credited human endeavor behind the music, that they'd started to be verified on Spotify. They'd been verified as mainstream global music stars. And that's where the point that it got ridiculous. I think, to go back to my idea as music for application, you know, music to do the washing up to, music to run to, music to sleep to and relax to, and how we as consumers have become unambitious in our listening because of that. I think the problem with that is if we follow the money once again, right, and we talk about a corporation that isn't Spotify, but Spotify-like, they're sitting there going, this is great. This is great. This is great. We're saving a little bit of money. There's a few more beans at the end of the year on our books, but I just feel like there's a bit of an issue. And the issue is these human beings that we keep having to pay. And I have seen with my own eyes AI music creation software that is getting not far away from creating music that is as good as the music on Deep Focus or Peaceful Piano. And that is the next stage. And at that point, you are listening to music created by AI, created by robots, dressed up as being from human beings. And we do start to stumble towards George Orwellville at that point in time.
Do we not think that on some level that is that not already happening? Because I feel like at a certain point, there are humans writing these songs. They're not taking credit for them, but there are humans writing these songs. is there not a scenario, and maybe this is what you're describing, but we're just not there yet, where it's the human who's writing the algorithm and then the algorithm does the rest of the work?
I saw an app earlier this year in San Diego. A startup is called Soundful with one L. I'd suggest people check it out. It's been created as a platform. There are a few of these. TikTok acquired one called Duke Deck, I believe. It's been created, this specific app has been created to kind of help musicians in the studio to instantly create, I guess, backing tracks and stems that they can then turn into their own music. But at the same time, it can knock out a pretty passable, pretty impressive entire track in various genres. And this is what I mean. If our expectations as an audience are low enough to not actually care who the artist is performing on a record, what their intent is and what their personality is, then the inevitable next step is that the music is going to be created by machines.
I was talking earlier about dance music, and I do think sometimes there are people who go to the club who don't care who's DJing, don't care who makes the music. They just want to be absorbed in the environment. And maybe that's not radically different. Maybe that's the after hours version of sitting at your desk and trying to get absorbed in your work. Philosophically, do you feel that those are different?
I think if we go back to the intent and this time put it on the audience, why do they go to the club? They go to the club to feel an overwhelming supernatural connection to the music. And so it's completely different. Instantaneously, it's completely different.
Okay. Fair. I'm mostly just devil's advocating here. Like, I do think, and this is something that I think comes for me after writing about music professionally for 20 plus years, is learning and trying to be mindful of the fact that not everybody uses music the same way that I use music. Not everybody craves the same things that I personally crave from music. And so that's why, to me, even though I understand the economics of this are sus, the business motivations of it are grotesque, the labor, the way that it devalues creative labor is absolutely unfortunate and foul. That said, I also know that there's entire universes of people for whom this suffices. I guess I try to be, I don't know, respectful. I don't know if that's the right word, but I try to be mindful or aware of the fact that not everybody's going to view it through the same lens that I do, even though low-key, we're on the same page.
Here's the other place that it leads. So the other week I spoke to a company called Strange Fruits. They've just rebranded themselves Fruits Music.
And wisely, I would say.
Yeah, very wisely. They have not a dissimilar model to Epidemic Sound. One of the playlists that they have created, this was written about in Rolling Stone, it wasn't me that wrote it, is for one of these purposes, you know, relaxation or sleep. I think it's sleep. And on Spotify, you have to play a track for more than 30 seconds for it to trigger a royalty payment. And this company has made a playlist of 2,000 plus tracks. Many of the tracks, about half of them, are about 31 seconds long. You know, the rest of the tracks are like less than a minute long. And when I spoke to the founder, he basically said, we are showing up a flaw on Spotify. We are showing up an issue in the way that royalties are paid out. And we're going to continue to benefit from it as long as this stupidity continues to exist. I'm paraphrasing. That's effectively what he said. Yes, it's incredibly cynical and calculated, but at the same time, the music industry has left the barn door wide open on this stuff. And to a degree, only has itself to blame, or only has the streaming services to blame in the manner in which they pay out royalties, which is a discussion for a whole other show. But yes, it's not moving in a direction that I think is going to be artfully fulfilling, even to those, to your point, who don't have the greatest artful expectation of their music listening experience.
Well, as anyone who listens knows, what I need to focus, what I listen to, is American hardcore music. So, you know, this can't relate. Tim, I really appreciate you coming on and chatting about this with us, because it's beyond important for the implications, the economic implications of the music business. But also, I kind of love it as a milestone moment in how art gets made and how people's perception of art is going to evolve in the coming years. So I'm really glad we got a chance to chat about it today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Joe.
That is our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast Facebook. Get in the discourse, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, yada, 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 yada. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, and Pedro will be producing live.
Yes, I will.
Live production. Pedro, they're going to see all your tricks.
They're going to steal my moves.
They're going to see it.
They're going to steal my moves.
They are. They absolutely are.
What I have to do is wear like a marshmallow or dead mouse mask.
Oh, you're going to, that's your avatar? Pedro's going to come out in a mask.
Yes.
Okay, so Maroon 5 has moves like Jagger. We have moves like Rosado.
Exactly.
If you want to learn how to produce on the fly, September 15th, come check us out. Let's go out with a little bit of real music after an hour agonizing over fake music. This is the real Florida Water, Young Thug, Buddy J, from my number one album of 2014, Black Portland. Let's go be free. Let's go be dead. How it's supposed to be. I just want you close.